Today on our Tech for Business podcast, Jason, our virtual CIO, and Nate, our Director of Cybersecurity and VCSO, are joining us to continue our cybersecurity best practices series. And we are specifically talking about commercial workspaces. So, Jason, welcome back. You were just on a podcast last week, so thank you.
My ego is just so excited to get to be on twice in such a short period of time.
Yes.
But my travel schedule requires it because I'll be out on the road for about 2 weeks. So,
oh my gosh.
You know, you guys are going to miss all my talking while I'm gone.
We'll have you back again.
I have enough. I'll get enough content to make up for it. So.
Yeah, Nate's our other one. Yes.
Don't do all the things Jason told you to do, according to the So you get all the V titles, the V's and the C's today. So
yes,
this will be exciting.
Yes, all the letters, the alphabet soup.
That's right.
I like to start with Jason, actually, because we're talking about commercial workspaces and cybersecurity, and I'm actually interested, kind of being our resident expert about this industry, what the relationship is when you talk to and when you work with commercial workspaces. What is kind of their mindset when it comes to cybersecurity? Are they really prioritizing it like they should? Is there a lot of pushback with implementation? What do you kind of see when you're out there?
And what the heck is commercial workspace? Because someone's probably listening to this like, I work in the commercial space.
You're talking about the place where my chair is, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
No, you're right. That's a good call. And it's funny because it's an industry. It's a niche. I need to go look up the correct pronunciation because 48 years in and I still haven't figured it out. But it is we're talking about businesses that sell products and services to other businesses to help furnish their workspace so that people have a comfortable, productive place to work. I think the buzz phrase right now, which is fair, is earn the commute. So we're trying to help people understand that a workspace is more than just a collection of chairs and tables and things. It's designed purposefully to help people be productive, to have sort of these spontaneous interactions where creativity is born, big ideas are born. And that, you know, the argument is sometimes that isn't possible with the virtual tools and the way of interacting. I get that. I respect that. I also know there's a big push towards helping furnish those home offices and home spaces where people work full time with furniture, with products, with designs and technology that also help them do their best work safely. So you're not hurting your back by sitting in a crappy chair from your kitchen or folding chair. You know, COVID, I think, brought the number of chiropractic visits spawned by COVID is in part a justification for the entire industry that I support. So yeah. What we're talking about, or what I'm referring to specifically and where I really focus my time, are the dealerships that sell those products and services, typically aligned with a major manufacturer. If you equate it to a vehicle dealership, you're talking, you know, Chevrolet versus Ford. So maybe Steelcase versus Miller Knoll versus Allsteel. You know, there's these different manufacturers, and dealerships tend to cluster up in large cities where other businesses live, based on local, typically owned, either a family owned or small business owned. I wouldn't call it a franchise. These are independently owned and operated businesses. And those businesses have a wide variety of perspectives on how to prioritize the investments in security and technology. Some believe truly that it's like buying a boat where it's a hole in the water you just pour money into and you get to enjoy it once in a while. They spend as little as possible on IT because it's a pure cost of doing business. And unfortunately, those tend to be the ones that have the most unpredictable failures and get ransomed, you know, most often. I think a step up there, Nate, I think you've got some great perspectives on there. Money is often a barrier. But I think Nate's got some great content to talk about here. But in addition to it, when I look at these dealerships, and again, an area that Nate specializes in, understanding the regulatory climate we live in has changed. And for these businesses who do business with other businesses to thrive and be able to even be part of the vendor program that their clients belong to, they have to get serious about the alphabet soup of compliance requirements. So whether it's CMMC 2.0, following an IT management program that their insurance provider requires, if they're in healthcare, HIPAA, if they're taking credit cards or, there's all the PCI, there's all these different sort of regulatory requirements. Luckily, there are many IT management programs, some of which are free to refer to, which I think Nate will talk to. I don't want to scoop him too badly. But these are all part of this alphabet soup. But understand, this industry spends less than almost every other vertical that I've ever looked at. You know, to me, the shock and awe characteristic is, I think in terms of Gartner's research into a percentage of revenues that a business invests in their own technology programs, 3% is typically on the way low end of the chart. when I look at dealerships that I work with, and often dealerships I work with don't even have an IT budget determined yet. They have a rough idea of what they spend based on what flows through their accounts payable system. But when I break it down and look at it, they're spending less than 1% of revenues on IT. Yeah. And I've talked before about productivity implications of this, which is just, are your designers, are they producing workspace plans and drawings and renderings to sell stuff quickly? Do your people have good business systems? But the implications from a security standpoint are massive. And I heard Nate starting to get a word in edgewise, so I will pause.
I'm trying to slip in here.
All right.
I'll put more periods in my sentences. Yeah, in terms of those budget percentages, so just a little more context behind that of how low that is. Manufacturing is one that people tend to look at and say technology doesn't really exist in manufacturing. There are obviously use cases outliers to this where you can have extremely advanced manufacturing facilities, right? Massive factories, robots, all that type of stuff. But in the small and medium business space, you tend to see that manufacturing is still using technology from 20 years ago, right? They don't want to invest, or maybe they haven't budgeted to say, this automation system is going to cost me $1.2 million to upgrade. So I'm just going to hold it for 20 years, essentially, right? And then they go make that investment. But it's more those like big stepping blocks that they have to walk up to rather than a nice progression to get to that next level up. So in manufacturing, we tend to see that's like 2.5 to 3.5% on average. So the fact that this is less than 1% on average should be really telling that it's even behind some of the manufacturing. If you look at general business, it tends to be more that 3 to 5-ish percent. And then once you start getting into the regulated spaces, it can be upwards of over 10% of your revenue is tied into IT and security and that type of stuff. So, and then one of the things that I was going to mention for Jason, or that kind of tying off of Jason, was essentially the concept of supply chain management, right? Is you have these major providers, you know, for example, like Steelcase, like he had mentioned, and the others, of they are doing their vendor due diligence to ensure that these commercial workspaces are doing their due diligence. Because, for example, as you're designing these files and everything, and they're passing files back up to get into the manufacturing, are you feeding malicious, you know, files back up? If you're not doing the due diligence down here, or again, they don't want to disrupt their supply chain. And so if the commercial workspace hasn't done their due diligence and is highly susceptible to a major outage, you know, for any reason, it doesn't matter whether or not it's just system outages, cybersecurity incident, that type of stuff, that creates unpredictability to their supply chain. And so they're trying to ensure that these commercial workspaces or their supply chain meets or exceeds their own security standards. And that's why you tend to see larger organizations push down requirements downstream to say, if you want to be a vendor of ours, you got to do this. Yep. And that's usually just the start of where you see things. I can get into cybersecurity insurance and, you know, all that type of stuff, but it's very, very similar. Is you're often forced into this type of stuff, whether or not you like it or not. Right.
No, and that's a perfect setup, Nate, because you're hitting on a number of good points, and that, you know, again, that's why you have the job you have, right? And I will say, you know, we're not beating up on Steelcase, although I will say I have a history with two organizations that have very prominent cybersecurity sort of news headlines tied to them, which is I used to work for Target Corporation. And at the time, I worked at Target Corporation managing the IT operations of a commercial furniture dealership that they owned that was a Steelcase dealer. And so luckily, we, because of the nature of our business, had chosen to separate our IT operations from Target. We were effectively not connected to Target during their very publicly, how should we say, played out sort of Black Friday situation, right? Unfortunately, also during, so, you know, that was part of my history. And again, we were informed by the idea that we were being audited by a larger corporation, but also had to have a cost structure that matched up with other commercial furniture dealerships out there. So the nature of my approach to leading a technology organization that was in that commercial workspace dealer vertical was I had to do it to Target standards, but I had to do it to a budget that was typical of that 1% of revenue. So it was very, very challenging, but But challenges are part of what IT does. You know, it's not an excuse that, well, is it challenging? I can't do it, right? I tell my kids, it's hard, but you have to figure it out. And you know, that's where creativity and you know, the grit and getting a great team together helps you achieve those things. But I was also part, you know, associated with Steelcase. And again, not a disparaging, Steelcase does a wonderful job with technology and has one of the more advanced, frankly, practices out there, and has some dealers with some very good IT leaders that I continue to work with, network with today. But Steelcase was subject to a supply chain attack, and that was public. I'm not scooping anything that wasn't in the news already. And that led to their dealers ultimately being attacked as well. And that's just, that's the way these things work. I believe it was a sort of a horizontal move from another, whether it was a healthcare provider or somebody else, jumped across and got to Steelcase and then got to their dealerships. And that's the way these things work. So you are absolutely right. In fact, the CIO of another manufacturer, and I won't cite who that was just for their confidentiality, did indicate that the greatest vulnerability that most manufacturers in this vertical space have is their own dealerships, not because of explicit negligence, because there really isn't a specific program that any manufacturer that has these dealership chains has imposed upon those dealerships, at least that I'm aware of to date. Again, not a criticism, although it's a suggestion I would make, is you know, the nameplates are on the building, right? If you're a Steelcase dealer, you have a Steelcase logo, you know, above or below your, the name of your business. Maybe if you're Miller Knoll, same thing, Allsteel, et cetera, et cetera. And I would say one of the recommendations I would make to the industry as a whole is, because what Nate mentioned is so critical, that the businesses we want to win together, whether it's a manufacturer going direct to a potential client, but implementing the solution through their dealer network, the dealer is still involved. And helping those dealerships understand the relatively sophisticated landscape that is driven by regulatory requirements and just general best practices to make your business safe, that would be very helpful. Because, you know, I love to work with these dealers individually. And to be honest, it's probably a very profitable vertical for us to chase as a business, because they need help. They need, yeah, in some cases, they need a lot of help. But there is a beauty in, you know, I've learned a lot about design. The design is sometimes seems almost unintentional. It's not. Design is sometimes, things that look simple are often very complicated to get to that level of user-ingested simplicity, if you will, the user experience being simple. And an IT framework that embraces performance and flexibility, but also security, is incredibly important. And I will say the one of the areas within the commercial workspace sort of technology stack that I've really specialized is around interior designers. And I'm super happy with something Nate brought to my attention, because for 15 years, I've been chasing the idea that these interior designers run a tool set that is often not real big on worrying about security and sometimes required elevated permissions to run. Well, the simplest solution for IT was to give all of our designers admin rights and maybe make them sign a piece of paper saying, I'll be careful, I won't do bad things. But the fact is those users are under assault in ways they don't even realize. So it's not just a matter of clicking a bad email or whatever else it is. They could connect to a Wi-Fi network. Again, attack vectors we haven't thought of are a risk. And so Nate brought a technology to my attention called ThreatLocker, which really displaces something that Microsoft had produced, which was, I believe, called AppLocker. It was a tool that let us, at a more granular level, provide only permission to certain applications so a user, like a designer, could run the programs they needed, but not expose their entire computer to the ability to just install whatever happened, including things they didn't want to have happen. That's, you know, having admin rights or the admin rights problem. Admin rights is cited in every good sort of cyber best practice policy, says, thou shalt not. Yeah. Give admin rights. In fact, when I was an IT director, I didn't have elevated permissions because it was a risk. You know, people can look me up on LinkedIn and know that's somebody I should target, because if they have elevated permissions, I've got keys to the kingdom. So some of those best practices actually push you very hard away from that. So anyway, looking at technology that is easy to implement, something like ThreatLocker allows us to deploy a technology that gives granular permissions only where that designer needs to protect them, but also has a great framework behind it of services that says, if they say, I need to get into something that you haven't thought of, they can click a button in, you know, behind the scenes, something I'm kind of proud of because Nate has, again, great ideas and great technology. We have a, I don't recall, Nate, remind me what it's called. It's the service that allows ThreatLocker to look at the question and within 10 minutes, we approve or we deny this request because it's safe, or no, it's not.
Yeah. So we actually, in ThreatLocker, the way that it works is, and can I just back up one step, because there's something that I just wanted to mention, and I promise I'll come back to it.
There's no rules here.
Someone listen to this and listen to you say remove local admin, and they're probably already gone by this point. If you're still here, it doesn't need to be as painful as it sounds. That's the one thing I wanted to say, because every single time we say remove local admin, often the first thing is, I'm just going to hear complaints all day about it. And it's going to be a lot of IT admin burden, right? Because again, once you remove it, IT has to come down, put in the password every single time on that machine. Mm-hmm. That's where these tools fit in. And also just jumping back to the supply chain and cybersecurity insurance questionnaires, this privilege access management is something that is showing up. That's exactly what this is talking about. So with that being said, what actually happens on the back end is every time, so we deploy this tool, it learns what's already in the environment, right? So you don't need to worry about all the manual stuff that something like Microsoft AppLocker used to do. AppLocker is a pain in the side to actually get configured properly. No dirty words. So this goes in, learns all the environment. It is able to build all the policies for all the designers and groups. You can say, learn this for all similar designers. So if one person has one version, this one has the other version, it's learned. You don't need to do it twice. When they send in that request, like Jason mentioned, it goes to our team here. And then at that point, we can take that executable, run it through a secure VDI, that sandbox. When that runs, it goes in and says, here's all the files that were touched, the registry settings that were touched, the internet connections that it touched, and everything else that, checks out on like virus total for that, signature hash. We can see if it's a known malicious software running in a secure environment. And then when it runs in that VDI, it learns all the files that were executed. And then it learns it, brings it back to the system, and we can say approve, let it run. And then that user gets a prompt that says, this was approved and validated. Go ahead and execute it. All of that is done typically within 10 minutes. I actually pulled the median recently, and all of that is typically done in 3.5 minutes. So it's extremely quick. So when we're talking about business flow and the criticality of these designers to be able to operate efficiency, gone are the days when you remove local admin, have to submit the IT ticket for the thing, wait for them to get done with their lunch break, call you back, do that type of stuff. No, it's literally on the fly. We're touching things within minutes while also running it through a secure VDI to ensure that it is not actually malicious before you actually run it.
And the manifestation of that, Nate, and this is, I boil things down because I have to, because we're talking about an industry that our obligation is to help them understand why you should spend the money, not because I want to buy a boat, but because it's important for you as a business. I want you to thrive. I want you to succeed. We want to be a partner to you that helps you do better. And the thing is, what this is addressing is designers in particular, or other people who have those other permission needs, just need to be able to do their work efficiently. And this process allows us to layer very advanced IT security and protection onto a very simple business problem, which is that designer hits a stop point. In less than 10 minutes, we can securely approve what they need to do to function in their job and to keep going. So it's giving a user a better experience. It is addressing probably one of the single biggest threat vectors in any business today, whether you're a commercial furniture dealership or not. And from a cost standpoint, Nate, it's very affordable. And I'm not saying this as someone who's trying to sell it. I'm saying it as someone who would have bought it for what we sell it for as an IT director, almost without further evaluation, because it's what, $10 a month or something? It's cheaper than half. For $10 a month, it slices, it dies, the supplies are limited.
If you just go do the math on just the labor compared to what this is actually doing, it's dirt cheap. So
it is incredibly affordable. And it's inexpensive. It's easy to implement because that's part of what we do. And it gives your end users a better experience doing their work in a safe way. And that is the theme that I talk to commercial furniture dealerships about, is you don't have a big IT budget. In fact, most of you don't have an IT budget. So the first thing I'll do is sit down with you in that consultative role. So whether I'm wearing my VCIO hat or my strategic advisor hat, let's understand what you're actually spending money on. Looking at your contracts to consolidate. Sometimes it's not just about getting you to an even lower IT budget. It's saying, let's take the money you're already spending and invest it more wisely, because you may not know where the opportunities exist. That is my job, is to help you understand where do those opportunities exist. Now we've got a little bit of money freed up. What are the greatest sort of investments we can make? In some cases, you don't even have to spend money. You just need to spend a little bit of time and energy. So the money would be in the form of maybe labor resources, but to make some minor changes. I can't tell you how many dealers still have multi-factor authentication not enabled. Although I think Microsoft is now making it mandatory. If you use Microsoft 365, So meaning the keys to the kingdom, your stuff is out in the internet. It's accessible to all the state actors, whatever else is. And a lot of them didn't have multi-factor authentication, meaning you get a pop up on your phone. Hey, you tried to log in. You entered your password. But is this really you? Please click a button to confirm. It is a critical, every single ransomware situation where a client has actually been, you know, their files are encrypted, they're shut down. It almost always starts with that sort of situation. So anyway. It's important. It's part of an IT program. It's a challenge, but that is what we're here to do. And I think, you know, Nate, you had some recommendations. I want to put you on the spot here and say, if you were sitting down with the business leader and you had 5 minutes or less to say, I've got a list of three things I'd love you to consider doing, even if I don't help you with it, what would those kind of, give me the top three things, if it's that short a list, that you'd recommend to someone who doesn't have a lot of money to spend to help improve their security posture today?
Yeah, this is a good transition. The one thing that I did want to say is we talked a little bit about ThreatLocker there. That is obviously a licensed solution. But the one thing that I want to say is this industry typically doesn't have money. So I did want to include some free stuff, other than time and energy that Jason had mentioned. So we found that because these dealerships are saying, I'm trying to protect myself from others for the most part, right? Because of past experiences. So that's a tool that can help you out, right? Because nothing can run in your environment unless it's approved. Other free recommendations is, number one, just remove local admin permissions. It is one of the most dangerous things you can do in your environment. Now, you can do that without a licensed solution. You just have to account for the labor to be able to support it, right? Number two, IT admins, if there are IT admins in these environments, if you are using domain admin to log into your workstations to provide support for these users, it is the worst thing you can possibly do in your environment paired with local admin. Every single time that we see privilege escalation in an environment from a workstation, it is almost always related to that. Is IT, we're just, I don't want to say we're lazy, but it's a lot of work to get the proper setup done. And so when someone says, oh, I manage all the servers and I can get into anything with my domain admin credentials, let me just go hop onto this workstation because I don't, you know, it's what I know, it's what I memorized. When you do that, what happens is that I'm going to get a little technical here, but this is speaking to the IT professionals here. So when you do that, your password hash is cached on that system. When a user has local admin permissions, they can go grab that hash. They don't need to even crack your password to take that and send it right over to the domain controller and log in and compromise the entire network. There's something called pass the hash. It's literally like one of the number one things that we see to quickly compromise the environment. Does user gets compromised, whatever it is, malicious macro, it doesn't matter what it is, phishing link, they get into the network, reverse shell, someone hops in, grabs a password hash, sends it to the domain controller. They didn't even need to work hard to compromise it. So if you're doing that, stop using domain admin. Go set up some type of like PC admin that you use only for PC support. You can push that out via group policies to inject it into the workstation admin group. And if that seems like too much work, at a minimum, take your daily driver domain admin account, which I hope it's not your daily driver for checking email and stuff. But if you have a dedicated admin one, take a look at the protected user security group in Active Directory. It is designed to help put controls around that password caching and strong authentication within the environment. So again, I'm going technical and I'm almost done. So for those that aren't technical, bear with me for just 30 more seconds. When you put protected users in, it forces Kerberos authentication rather than something that's legacy like NTLM. And then what it also does is it prevents that password caching on that local system. So that way, if someone does hop onto that, there's nothing there to grab. So it can cause a couple issues with like remote desktop around the environment if you're doing that. But again, your domain admin should be logging for domain controllers only. That's the only time you should ever use that account. So those are all free. So, and I'm done with the technical rant. Sorry.
No, I absolutely. And so from a practice standpoint, right, in a dealership environment, I had very, very good engineers because I didn't, you know, you don't want me behind the keyboard doing things, right? So as the IT director, I did not even have local admin, right? I had no domain admin account. We kept those credentials protected, locked away, and they were available if needed through a request process. We could get access to elevated permissions for a specific purpose and even documented the reasoning we were using that elevated account. So it was a matter of changing a business process around how IT functioned and also empowering business to say, you know, IT is not the only one with these credentials if needed. If something happens to the IT team or something else, you know, this is a business problem. So account management as a whole is a inexpensive way to deal with this. I will qualify some things Nate said because I agree with him. But there is the economy of time as well as money. And while free things don't necessarily cost money directly, we do have to think about, you know, for the AppLocker example, you know, ThreatLocker is a wonderful solution because it is effectively turnkey. It solves the problem for a predictable cost and includes the complexities behind the scenes in making it happen. A tool like AppLocker, which is free, does similar things, but it has a very high cost of management over time, which is hard to capture. You know, sometimes IT people just thematically will have a tendency to say, oh, I can do that cheaper. I can do that for free. But they're not accounting for what they're getting paid, and they're not accounting for the opportunity cost that spending time chasing what I would call minutia. You know, who's flying the plane while you're back serving drinks? Okay. Yeah. Like, who's watching the bigger picture? Who's doing that? And that if you're spending all of your time on that service delivery sometimes and not utilizing services or products that can help you do these things time efficiently, you're potentially missing other risks to the organization. So you've solved a small problem over here, and meanwhile, Rome is burning over there. So it's just, it is a matter of balancing those problems. So I'm going to shut up again and let Nate continue with the second recommendation he has.
Well, I was just going to say for the time, one of the things that a lot of IT professionals don't consider is opportunity costs or opportunity loss, right, is we don't mind oftentimes doing the work to say, well, I'll just set it up because I get to play with a new tool, and we love playing with new tools, right? Or again, I can take 20 minutes out of my day, help someone out, you know, and because again, IT people by nature tend to want to care and help others with their IT issues. What this means for the business, though, is that now you have your IT professional that is maintaining or sustaining or, you know, just not driving the business forward. And so let's say you go have your, whatever it is, $80,000 IT professional, and they're always just implementing new tech to lock things down or always trying to log into systems and put in a password to help them out or whatever it is. You have to count that as the loss of what they could have done to actually drive the business forward, be more competitive, save costs elsewhere, improve efficiencies to make you more money. And so those are the things that we're really trying to avoid is just, I often say, just give the grunt work to someone else, because as an IT professional, I want to provide value, which means align better to the business and say, what are your goals and how do we get IT to, again, work with you to drive it forward, right?
Yeah. And I got a sort of point here because you hit something that you struck a nerve here, and a couple of things. Right. First of all, I look at it as the plane analogy, right? You know, put on your mask before you start helping other people, because if you run out of oxygen, you can't be helpful. So and what I would equate that to is poorly funded IT departments. And this is a role that IT leaders in these organizations need to embrace. You need to go figure out where you're going to find the money to do the things you have to do. Right. But that opportunity cost is so tremendous. And we get caught up in minutia to the point that we no longer can be proactive. And what the warning I will give dealers I work with before I talk about anything else is your team doing things that drive your business forward? Or are they doing things they find interesting from a technology standpoint that are just commodity services? And I utilized a managed service provider as an IT professional in a dealership because my team, for example, patching was a struggle. You know, it was like, when do we have time to do this? We're doing projects over here. We're doing support over here. Support is a very reactive, important function. But really the outcome of support should be, okay, we saw an issue, we fixed it, but how do we prevent it from ever happening again? And so it's a constant, it's not just, I'm always going to be there, put the fire out and swap the keyboard out or whatever else it is. It's constantly, you know, okay, Nate, way to bring up the oxygen mask not working thing. Thank you. Appreciate that. Sorry, we have a little side chat going.
Sorry, for those that
aside from the
fact
that the mask may work a quarter of the time, as I'm about to get in a plane this afternoon. Thank you for that, Nate. No, it's just incredibly important. The opportunity cost, it's not, this is about maturing our outlook on how we manage the environment. And to Nate's point, being proactive and avoiding those opportunity costs where you're doing the right thing in the moments, but the wrong thing in the long term, you're putting the environment at risk. And that is where you need to have mature conversations with leadership about, I would almost call it IT theater. And this is, it's almost a psychological thing where we are so busy trying to look busy and important because we don't want to get fired. We don't want to lose our job. We want to feel needed. You know, I hate to say it, but a lot of us as IT people got in because we like to help people. But that instinct to immediately jump in and be the visible hero who rides in and solves the problem can have detrimental effects on a bigger picture look at the organization. You're so busy fighting those fires, you're not preventing them, you know, the forest from burning down in the first place by doing good, carving out the undergrowth and doing controlled burns when you need to. You know, it's all of that stuff. So this does get into a bigger IT management philosophy, which has to happen at a dealer principal level. They need to be supported by, it's about IT being accountable. I would say if you don't understand the EOS framework, Traction is a great book to read. It's bigger than just IT, but I'd say a lot of successful IT organizations are embracing EOS as part of a business strategy that they are helpful in implementing, because IT is really the machinery that the business uses to implement their processes to be more efficient, to be more innovative, et cetera, et cetera. If you're spending all your time fixing broken mice and keyboards and trying to fight fires that you may have inadvertently created because you don't have good security in place, you're not effectively doing your job. And again, that's, I hate to pitch it, but that's one area where I believe I can help a lot of dealerships, and Nate can help a lot of dealerships, is talk to us about giving you an agnostic view of what's really going on in your organization, finding out what the problems are, and then helping you advocate with your leadership team for the money, the resources to do that job effectively, because it's going to help them do business more efficiently. They're going to win new clients. They're going to, and whether you start with a cyber insurance program that says you have to do these things, mm-hmm. and then figure out, okay, we have to do these things anyway, but how can we use these investments to make our users more productive at the same time, which is completely possible. So sorry, I'm preaching. I'm going to kick my soapbox out. Poof. And then Nate, get back to, we're looking for number three, Nate. So we've heard who number two works for. Where's number three?
I didn't really have three.
All right. I can keep talking. Don't worry.
I don't know. Connect with the business leaders, right? Yeah. It's really, I think my number three is, because that is also free, is mm-hmm. find out what the goals are of the organization and just figure out how can you help and be more mm-hmm. more effective, right? And if IT is trying to better align with that, kind of to Jason's point, is we want to look busy. Mm-hmm. That's the conversation with your business leaders that are going to have more value, saying, I don't want to just look busy. I want to help you. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you start shifting that conversation and kind of the influence that you have over these leaders as well, a little bit, saying we're not just a cost center. We can actually turn into a profit center a little bit as well. And so it's hard to do, because one of the things I have heard many, many times is, and maybe you're new into these environments and saying, wow, everything is really far behind. I don't want to bring up how bad it looks to these leaders, because then they're probably just going to can me. Right. But if you can go into them and say, look how bad it is, but I want to make a change. Right. Mm-hmm. And do that, that provides way more value than, and again, hopefully the business leaders recognize that rather than saying, well, then what have you been doing this whole time, right? And so,
but you have to be a level of amnesty offered. Like, look, I think this is important, because it's funny. This topic is about security, right, and about cyber insurance. Yeah. But I would argue that the root cause of these businesses not investing in themselves effectively is actually, and I'm not saying a leadership problem is that this is your fault, dealer principals, and now you're never going to take a call from me again. It is. There is not a real understanding of how this IT as a business practice is roughly 20 or 30 years old, if that much, right? I mean, I grew up in the industry where, in fact, my high school guidance counselor told her I wanted to go in IT as a career. I started banging away at a keyboard when I was 12 years old, when my dad brought home this old beat up IBM clone of some sort, and I was playing a stupid text-based adventure game sitting on a Swedish kneeling chair that I don't think I can sell today because it would blow out your knees. So it'd be an ergonomic. Anyway. All of that is, as I always over-contextualize things, leads to this idea that, I lost my train of thought. That's terrible. Totally lost it. Boom. Thank you. we really need to work towards helping business leaders, you know, understand what we're trying to do here is solve these complex problems that really help the business. But we as IT leaders need to let go of things that aren't really adding value. And I'd say a lot of what IT does today is, you know, it's like you walk up to the light switch, you flip it, you just get lights in the room. Many IT services today can be offered on a subscription basis. The question I would ask most IT people in those organizations is your business in the business of selling technology? And that's why you're spending all your time supporting a technology environment that requires a lot of care and feeding. Or is your job to help innovate in the commercial workspace sector, to help clients understand and innovate? And you can do that with technology products. You know, one of the most compelling conversations I will take, again, a cautionary tale. My career is fraught with doing things the wrong way and learning the right way. My first real big mentor was a CFO in a company. And he told me, Jason, you can do almost anything you want to do, but you have to justify it in a business context first. And mm-hmm. taught me how to talk to business leaders in that budgetary context, understanding their goals. The first thing I think most of us should do if we want to really get serious about security is go all the way back to the basics of how are we justifying the things we're spending money on? Are we contextualizing them in the business we're doing today? And then are we working with the leadership team to secure resources to build an actual strategy around IT? And part of that strategy is almost paint by numbers. There are free programs out there today. CIS is one of them, I believe, Nate. The ITIL has programs where you can look and it will give you a paint by numbers example of how to implement IT best practices that will secure your environment as part of daily blocking and tackling. And the great thing is, in many cases, if you look at whether it's a managed service provider or going to Microsoft and subscribing to Microsoft 365, a lot of those services have this capability built into them. So you could implement some very advanced IT security capabilities on top of an IT sort of service delivery program that has this baked in. Another great way to get to this place is to start with cyber insurance, because your cyber insurance provider is going to require you to do certain things to get a policy that will actually work. So they will often guide you. In fact, in many cases, I saw a client that was provided not only great security tools and an audit process that helped them understand where their gaps were. They were offered things like free training, free user testing, something we might charge a client for. That's included in their cyber insurance policy. So when I'm looking at building a strategy for a client, I'll look at what are the things you get for free from your cybersecurity provider. What are these free frameworks and how do they apply? Are you in a regulated industry? Are you working with a lot of GSA clients, government work? That's going to come with essentially a paint by numbers set of requirements you have to meet anyway. Well, now we know. Now we know exactly what it is we're trying to achieve. Then let's map that against our business strategy and say, okay, how do we invest in things that hit those requirements in the most cost effective way? And then look at it. Look at the time that you're spending as an IT professional. Should I be, it's important. We need, the mice and keyboards need to be available. The user has to have a working laptop, but can we use proactive tools to help us not have to go to every single keyboard and mouse remotely, whatever else it is? And I think over time, this is where there is such a great opportunity to help support these dealerships because they haven't had a lot of money to spend in IT, but the industry is being forced to effectively grow up. There's a ton of consolidation happening. There's a lot of outside investment in these dealerships themselves. They occupy a wonderful space. Don't get me wrong. I love working in that dealer space because we get to talk. For me as an IT person, I love working in the dealer space, even though we have a fraction of the budget I think we need, because we get to talk about workspace problems and how the manifestation of what we're doing as technologists actually affects people's experience. So whether it's, we downtown Minneapolis did this great project where we renovated two floors, 60,000 square feet or something like that. And one of the problems we identified was we're spending a ton of money on cabling. Every time we got to move all the furniture around, we're in a historic building. I got to put corduroys in, which requires an X-ray because the building's so old.
Yeah.
Is there another way we can do this? And we said, well, we can do Wi-Fi. And everyone's like, well, Wi-Fi is terrible. You can't use Wi-Fi as a primary connection technology with interior designers. It will not work. And we said, well, unlike my kids. Well, why? Why not? Why can't we do that? Why can't we do that? Why can't we do that? And so we asked the questions and said, well, you need to spend some money. I'm like, well, okay. If I look at the cost of retrofitting my wireless technology, which required a whole network rearchitecture, it was about a $25,000 or $30,000 project. When I looked at the cabling budget for just that space, it was like $80,000. So all of a sudden, what was impossible because we hadn't actually done the analysis, this is actually a really good idea. I feel stupid for not looking at this earlier. And so we realized the business case was we move furniture around a lot. Corduroys are expensive and it doesn't give people flexibility. Even before COVID, it doesn't give people flexibility to just work wherever they want in our space. And a commercial workspace services company, if they're doing a great job, actually invites their clients to come in and just use space, try things, and then they observe. And so by giving them access to a great wireless environment, which in the middle of downtown Minneapolis, for example, is really challenging. Everybody's got their radios turned up to 11. And so you're kind of fighting with this weird shared airspace and microwaves and craziness, but you can solve this problem. I know because I've seen it happen in a space that I was responsible for. And you know what? When I'm talking to other business leaders who are coming to us for advice about how to do stuff with workspace, and I can say, by the way, not only do we have great furniture applications, we've done some things with our own technology I think you should listen to. And it's a weird, it's sort of an asymmetrical approach to talking because I don't expect to hear from an IT person in a sales pitch about furniture. But it does affect their experience because in their space, guess what? They're having to run cables all the time. They're spending all this money. This might be a good application of technology for them, or whether we're using space occupancy sensing technology to understand what's happening in those spaces. Not only does that have some interesting security applications, it does help us understand, did we implement something that's useful, or the people just hate and they're not using? As much as I love it and I think it's great, it's just not useful. So how do we fix those things? And I think that does draw parallels to a good IT management framework, good IT monitoring, proactive tools. There is a concept, I think, if I were going to, again, talking to dealer principals about things that they probably should think about, Windows Defender, Trend Micro, whatever, Trend Antivirus. So these were tools. The traditional antivirus stack has very much changed. And there is a new concept, and I think Nate is nodding his head profusely. Oh, this is important. EDR, Endpoint Detection and Response. And I'm saying endpoint because, it's no longer I'm installing an antivirus package on my laptop and hoping for the best. Endpoint could be a laptop, a phone. It could be all these other devices. So it's taking away the specificity around this is a tool that only works on one thing and saying endpoints need to be protected. They need to detect things. Even if I don't have a signature, knowing something is a virus or a malicious piece of code, it is acting in a way that isn't normal. And then I need to respond to that. And a good endpoint detection and response tool will sort of self-regulate when it finds something going on, because humans can't react as fast as some, we're talking about fighting with the robots, if you will, bots and scripts. So you need to deploy tools that are intelligent enough to respond and are potentially backed up by a third-party service provider. I would say if you are not using a true endpoint detection and response tool, we favor SentinelOne, but there are great tools from companies like CrowdStrike. I believe Sophos has got some good, again, Nate could probably talk about the specifics, but you probably need to look at rethinking your approach because, if you're using the free Windows Defender because it's cheap, you're going to get hits and it's going to cost a lot more. And I don't like to fear sell, but it is just the reality. I haven't seen a client who hasn't implemented a real endpoint detection response system that hasn't been hit. And the other thing I would absolutely recommend that you dig into is your backup strategy. Way too many companies have their backups on the same network that their files live on, which is great until somebody gets in your network and encrypts your backups first and then encrypts the rest of your files. And then says, ha ha, you can't restore your backups, so on and so forth. There are great solutions out there. I think one of the products, again, I'll full disclosure, we sell it, but it's good. Datto allows us to make a backup that you can't actually get to without, sort of external controls. So your data is really what we would call air gapped, meaning it's not really connected to the network anymore. A conceptually similar concept where your data is protected and locked away after it gets backed up. So there is no easy way to jump across so that you always have the ability, if everything else fails, to bring your data back from one of these resources. So look at your backup strategy, make sure that your live data, the stuff that you're trying to protect, and the way that you're backing it up are not connected in a way that it's very simple. Because again, back to the conversation about credentials, way too many of us have way too many permissions. And you know what? If I go to LinkedIn, if I'm not a hacker, right? I'm not that guy. But if I go look at LinkedIn, I can produce a lot of information about who my likely soft targets are if I'm trying to do bad things. And I don't necessarily need to be a brilliant hacker. I can just start calling and asking some really smart. I can be charming and ask questions, and I can social engineer you into giving me information that will let me in. And those IT people, those business executives that have your profiles on LinkedIn, you're giving away a lot of information about who they should be targeting. And if you also have elevated permissions, that's a problem. So if nothing else, use the LinkedIn approach to self-assessing your security posture. The more public your identity is as an individual, the more likely you're going to get targeted. If you have elevated permissions, it could be a big problem for you. So there's my another piece of free advice for me.
Yeah. The only two things that I wanted to chime in on, one about EDR, one about backups, and these will be really, really quick, is EDR, there is something called the MITRE evaluations. So this is a third party that does Unbiased testing. So vendors submit their tool for evaluation every single year. And MITRE, it doesn't provide any commentary about it. It just says, here's the results. And then, you know, every vendor is going to go in and try and tailor it to make themselves look a little bit better and whatnot. When you're taking a look at those EDR solutions, go take a look at the MITRE evaluations to find the ones that are actually appropriate. I'm not going to bash on any of them. That's why the tools, you know, the tool exists, so you can make those own informed educations. There's a reason why we pick the ones that we pick. And then for the backups, the key term that you're looking for, if you have never dug deep into backups, is make sure they are immutable, which means that they cannot be tampered with. So again, if you're up on Azure, the Azure immutable backups are phenomenal. Just put in those retention policies, Datto, you know, Acronis, Axiom, whatever solution you have, Veeam, make sure that they are truly immutable, because we do see companies that say we have great backups until the threat actor gets into the backup controller and just pushes a delete downstream to the offsite backup, and then they're gone. And so we've seen customers that we've helped during like ransomware cases where they actually lost all their backups, even their offsite ones, because they were linked. And then at that point, they had to go send off their backups to a actual data recovery service and had to go pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to restore the business, essentially. So immutable.
I like that word
data when it comes to backups. So,
well, you know that, you know, there's, where do we start, right? If I'm talking to somebody who is a dealer principal or someone who's just concerned in the business, maybe they're an IT professional there, or they work for a manufacturer, and like, how do we protect ourselves? You know, to me as an industry, how do we get to a better place? And I think the first thing is just, you know, talk to somebody in the profession, you know, talk to your cyber insurance carrier. You know, I'm always up for a conversation, as you can hear, I like to talk. But someone like myself and Nate, you know, part of our job is to talk to clients. And now it says, hey, we're like a taxi, we're putting you on the clock is running. You know, we'll have that conversation before we talk about billing you to just understand, what are your goals? What are your strategies? And we'd love to give you some guidance. Some of that may lead you back to us, some of it not. You know, I think the key is understand, first of all, at a business, this is not a pure technology issue. This is protecting the business and really looking at not just, and I don't like fear. I really don't like the idea of saying, but this could happen to you, you need to buy it from us. You know, that is unfortunately a consequence of not having a great IT strategy built from the start. And so if I were going to put a call to action around this conversation, as Nate would put it succinctly, we need to start with understanding that IT can't be in this alone, that IT is there to protect, empower, and enable the business to do its best work. But we need to think about IT security cannot be a bolt-on to your IT strategy. It has to be central to that strategy. And that may require a complete rethinking of how you're doing technology. But this is kind of a golden time to do that. The things we can do as a service today and we can subscribe to as IT providers that aren't displacing our jobs, they're superpowering our jobs. They're letting us let go of minutia that may not be of value from a business standpoint. You know, again, they're looking at IT as a cost. Elevate yourself by finding things that we can put a better IT strategy in place with great security woven in. And I, as a technologist in a space that has all this opportunity to really showcase interesting things about workspace applications, I can be part of that conversation. I can help sell things. I can help convince clients that our business is the right choice for them to work with. All of these things tie together. So feel free to reach out. I'm available, you know, jason.lund@cit-net.com. Although I hear we have a new domain that might be even easier for people to find me at. But feel free to reach out. You can jump through our website. There is a commercial workspace services page with my contact information there. We'd love to talk to you. I'd say otherwise, start with your cyber insurance provider. They have some good stuff. And just, yeah, it's a complicated, but it's a really exciting time to think about all this stuff, because I do think designers in commercial workspace dealerships are what drove me to this industry. And there's a beauty in the design of a great IT infrastructure that empowers those users specifically, but the whole business to thrive, because we've thought about all those things. And it's a bit of an asymmetrical approach here, but you know, look at how your designers solve their problems and how complex solving these workspace issues with furniture and dealing with, you know, space plans you can't always control. Get in their heads a little bit and think about their process and get outside of your own way of normally solving problems, and then come back to this problem and talk to your business leaders and understand what their priorities are. do a raw assessment of your IT budget, figure out where those dollars and cents are, and you can get to a place pretty quickly that will make you more secure. And again, start the journey. You don't have to get to the end the first year, but start making things better incrementally, and you will be on a better path, and your business will thank you for it. So I would say, unless Nate, you got anything else, we can call that an episode.
No, I got my content for while you're out next week. So
I love it. And we talked about so much today. I'm going to have a lot of resources in the description. So if you are feeling a little lost, I recommend you check that out. Yes, check out our website. We do have a commercial workspace section, but also just general EDR, MFA, things you can do. Thank you so much, Jason and Nate, for joining us today. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe. If you have a question, a topic, or you want to talk to either of these two, please reach out to us at info@cit-net.com or head out to our website, cit-net.com/podcast. And we'll be back next week with an all new episode.